Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. Today is Thursday, July 25th, 2019, a notable day in American history, as it is the date of the birth of my mother, Midge Dechter Podhoretz, who is 92 today. I was writing letters to my kids at camp, trying to go through what it means to have been born in 1927. Like, that was the year that the first plane trip across the Atlantic took place. It was 24 years after the first air flight, 35 years after the first car, 7 years after the introduction of radio. You think of all the things that hadn't happened yet. There hadn't been a Great Depression, hadn't been World War II, there hadn't been the Holocaust, there hadn't been the creation of Israel, there hadn't been the Cold War and transistorization and television and the transformation of the world that she and people of her age have lived through is just staggering, and how close they were to the age before electricity and before the ability of people to travel more than 40 miles from their home without making a major expedition of it. Anyway, yes, I'm John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary, and with me as always, Christine Rosen in Washington, senior writer. Hi, Christine.
Hi, John, and happy birthday to your mom. She's a great role model to a lot of us.
Thank you very much. And here in studio, Noah Rothman, associate editor. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
And Abe Greenwald, senior editor.
Hi, John.
Executive editor, associate editor of editors.
I like it.
titles are. My mother is 92, as I've said, which also helps explain how I am 58 and I'm losing my marbles. Just so. All right, so who also thought perhaps to have been losing his marbles was Robert Mueller, who testified yesterday before two House committees and largely raised questions I'm sure he did not want to raise about his the freshness of his cognitive processes, let's say, and raised interesting questions about the singular determination with which, after he read that statement in April or whenever it was, the letter, the statement that he read, said he would not speak any further. I mean, maybe he did not want to speak any further because speaking further is a great difficulty for him, which I think is something that cannot be taken lightly and is certainly something that might have been transmitted to people, but I think the logic of what had gone on the past 2 years and the congressional fights within the Democratic caucus over the possibility, the necessity, the ideological force of impeachment made this appearance, these appearances, they could not fight for it and make it happen. After all this time, they had to have him there. And I guess I think also maybe the whole country had to have him there so that this more than two year, really since the day that Trump came into office, this 2.5 year fantasy that his presidency could simply be extirpated without the need for a vote, that he would be driven from office, he would be forced to resign, he'd be forced to flee, or he would be impeached and removed or something like that. That this has been a theme from the day that he was inaugurated, and unless I'm very much mistaken, and the Democratic Party goes completely insane, that theme came to a close yesterday afternoon when the second hearing before the House Intelligence Committee ended. I don't see how a single person who was not in favor of impeachment changed his mind and decided that impeachment was necessary in the House caucus. And I imagine that watching Mueller and seeing the weakness actually not only of his own performance, but in some sense, of the case that he was making, particularly in the obstruction part two, obstruction section of the report, the fact that he couldn't defend it or go beyond it or say anything eloquent about it, that some people who have moved inexorably in this direction may want to pull back and be saved from it by Nancy Pelosi and the House leadership willing to take the bullet of saying, we just can't do this. This is insane. We don't have the goods. That's the Republican-controlled Senate will not vote to convict. Therefore, this is a fool's errand. It's an empty exercise, and we will look shoddy and partisan and maybe a little nuts. Is anybody have any objections to this analysis?
I mean, I think as a practical matter, impeachment is off the table. I think in spirit, it lives on. And it remains to be seen how that manifests. I mean, I think one of the interesting things here is that, as we've seen since Trump's become president, there's this constant reversal of roles on the left and right. And I wonder now, I mean, we haven't gotten into it yet, the response on the left to Mueller's performance. But because they seem so disappointed in it on the left, I wonder what kind of doubt that they will be in casting on the report, while now the Republicans seem more or less satisfied with it.
Abe, you have a broader theory about how this could manifest that I think is worth going into, because if John's wrong and there really is an impulse towards sort of probably self-defeating craziness within the Democratic caucus, then it'll probably manifest as you see it unfolding.
Well, I mean, I think there's a chance that Democrats or the left more broadly will start looking at Mueller's performance and determine, therefore, that he sort of wasn't up to the job. I'm trying to, you know, put it politely. He wasn't as on top of the task as they had thought or had hoped, and therefore there needs to be an investigation and a new probe.
Yeah, so the new probe would take the form of an impeachment inquiry. The craziest members of the caucus will not acquit themselves as politely as you have. They will say that the gentleman's mental faculties are impaired. This wasn't a Mueller probe at all. It was directed by his subordinates, none of whom we can trust. The DOJ is compromised. There needs to be a new inquiry, and the only inquiry that can be done is in an impeachment inquiry in the House. Now, impeachment has never really been on the table. There's not enough members of the Democratic caucus. No, inquiry, period. Yeah. There's not enough members of the Democratic caucus who would support it. Though the inquiry.
Well, that doesn't mean that if it were put up to a vote, they wouldn't feel it necessary to support. We have another pre. The question is, put up to a vote that there should be an impeachment inquiry. Would a majority of.
Does it require 218?
Yeah.
Yeah, then I don't think it would actually survive on the floor.
All right. So. Some parts of an impeachment inquiry can be conducted without a full vote of the House. I mean, it could be done by the Judiciary Committee and therefore could be done simply as a project of the Judiciary Committee. But I think this is all foolish. This is all, as we say, narishkite, because what happened yesterday was for 2 years, the idea was that Robert Mueller was the person in America who knew what was going on. Or you could say Mueller and his probe, however you want to put it. Like everybody else was just speculating. They knew. They were creating a massive map of collusion, conspiracy, and obstruction. And we were told constantly along the way, More was coming. Indictments were coming. Things were coming. Important hits were coming. Trump was scared. People around him were terrified, all that. By the way, I think it's likely that Trump was scared and people around him were terrified. What happened was there were 37 people and entities indicted by Mueller, and he secured various convictions, most prominently of Paul Manafort. And none of it had to do with connections between the Trump campaign and Russia. Not a single charge was levied about connections between the Trump campaign and Russia. There were charges about people making false statements to Mueller in the course of the inquiry in which such questions were asked, but there was no... So this was, of course, the major question about part two of the report, which is there were credible, the report lays credibly out, 10 possible instances of obstruction, but with no under, but with no underlying crime. And fairness, you can, of course, stretch things to indict somebody for conspiring without an underlying crime. That is among the most controversial things that a jury ever has to deal with. Happens on Wall Street all the time that people walk because they are indicted on the grounds of conspiracies in which they should have known that something was a crime, or that they had said things to each other that rose the level of conspiracy, but that they couldn't prove the underlying offense, right? So that's a terrible way to indict someone. And obviously, a impeachment is a particular kind of indictment, right? It's not, it's a political act. It's not, it's a, you redefine, you have to define what a high crime or a misdemeanor is and lay it out. And so he didn't have the goods on conspiracy and obstruction or obstruction. And we were told over and over again that he did, he would, it was coming. There were bizarre leaks or whatever to various reporters demonstrating that. And if you think about the Manafort case, so if there was conspiracy, obviously Manafort would have been at the center of it. Manafort is going to jail for the rest of his life. So he has no incentive not to have cooperated, to give them what it was that they needed to go after Trump. I mean, it doesn't seem like a particularly self-sacrificing person who is going to die in prison because he wants to protect the wondrous legacy of Donald Trump's presidency. So,
well, he has one ticket out.
What's that?
Pardon.
Pardon, yeah.
Well, yeah. But, I mean, that's a terrible bet compared to what you could... What?
It's not hard for me to imagine.
I mean, it's not hard for me to imagine that he might fantasize about a pardon, but that doesn't mean that once the judge says to him, you're going to jail for 33 years and you're 69 years old, that you don't go, I better do something. Anyway, I'm just saying, like, we had 2 years of this and it's over. And, yeah.
Okay, so can I just say one thing to the idea that it's over? I don't think it's over. It's certainly not over in the minds of the, you know, self-identified resistance. I mean, the tweet that struck me as the most telling reaction to what was going on was Lawrence Tribe, the Harvard Law professor who's kind of gone off the deep end when it comes to his hatred of Trump. And he talked about how, you know, oh, I hate to say this, but Mueller has sucked the life out of impeachment now. But he talked about how our effort to save democracy and the rule of law from a lawless president is now, you know, really set back. And that, I think, is the pivot that's going to happen, right? This is no longer about, you know, Mueller, who they unfairly built up as some superhero who then disappointed them. It's about the rule of law and democracy. So now we're going to see a pivot in terms of the language with that. The one thing, and in deep defense of Mueller, who basically signaled to everyone on the right and the left that he had no interest in even sitting there and talking to them, was that the one thing he said that has not been getting a lot of attention that should is his very strong warning that Russian interference in American elections will continue, and that the bigger point, the bigger threat to democracy is that, and that that's an ongoing threat. It should be considered a nonpartisan threat, and obviously the Trump administration has no interest in dealing with that, but the Democrats don't seem all that keen to do it either. So I was really glad to hear him make that statement, but I don't think we're going to see, we might see a new strategy from the Democrats with regard to impeachment, but this idea that Trump is undermining democracy, that's going to continue. It's just going to be pivoted, and they're going to find new outlets for exploring that idea.
Democrats are going to use the Mueller report, as they should, in 2020, because it is extraordinarily right. damning to the Trump right. administration and the president. Let's be pretty clear about that. There was no collusion yes. with Russia, but it wasn't for lack of trying. If there was an effort made on the part of Moscow to provide the Trump campaign with the evidence it sought actively from Kremlin cutouts, it would have been there, and that would have been the link. The Mueller report is very clear. They tried and failed to work with Russian entities, and the president on multiple occasions sought to shut down or impede this investigation and was thwarted by his cooler heads around him and his subordinates. It wasn't, again, for lack of trying.
Okay,
I'm just not entirely sure it's the best idea for Democrats to keep shoving that down Americans' throats, though, because there's such fatigue on the collusion issue that I think that might override what so many Americans already know about the attempts to obstruct.
Okay, so there are two strands, right? And there were two sides of the report. There's the question of Russian interference in 2016, and then there is the question of Trump's obstruction. Those are the two parts of the report. So the confusion of the two is why the Trump administration is uninterested in pursuing the danger of Russian interference. This is not to praise them for doing so or to defend them from doing so. Trump made the decision, and I think it's a vulgar decision, and it's a false decision, and it's a sophistic decision, but a decision nonetheless to say the entire investigation is horse pucky, right? The entire thing is a witch hunt, and every aspect of it is nonsense, and they're just trying to get me, and I'm not budging, right? In early 2017, before Mueller was appointed, before all of this happened with Comey, Republican Richard Burr and Democrat Mark Warner, you know, on the, I guess, was it the Senate Intelligence Committee, you know, convened. They did a very serious report. There have been reports all over the place. Officials of the Trump administration, including the CIA director, the director of national intelligence, all that have said that the danger, the Russian interference in elections is a cardinal danger to the country. The president, for political reasons, made a political decision that he was going to try to discredit the entire report. Now, again, moral, we can go on and say, oh, he should have done better and all of this. But I don't think, looking back, that you can say that he made a political error. By doing what he did, he united his party and the right behind him on the grounds that there was something fishy going on here, and that this was just a fishing expedition looking for anything that could be gotten to get him out of there. Had he been a more responsible president, had he been a more sober president, had he been a more reasonable person, and tried to separate these lines to say, I think it's really important that we find out what the Russians did so we can stop them from doing it any further, but looking at me and my people and everything, that, for what we did, that's illegitimate. That would have been too complicated a plot line for him to handle and for him to sell. Again, I'm not making a defense. I'm trying to explain what happened. And of course, Democrats and liberals and the left and the media played right into his hands, because they also mixed the two up into a gigantic jumble, to the extent that the idea that somebody who worked for Trump had a conversation at any time in the last 15 years with somebody who had Russian citizenship was bad. If you actually look at what Michael Flynn was indicted for and had to resign from the administration because he lied to Mike Pence, right? That's what the line was. But what did he do? He made 5 phone calls to the Russian ambassador, attempting as the incoming national security advisor to prevent Russia from putting sanctions on the United States because we had thrown out 35 diplomats as a response to the Russian meddling. So Flynn calls the guy, apparently on his birthday or on Flynn's birthday, I can't remember, 5 calls, something like that. And what we now know is that he was saying, don't do this, we're coming in, things will be different. There is nothing illegitimate about him having done that. When asked about it, you know, under oath, he lied about it. Now, why he lied about it is a whole other issue, and, you know, and that was stupid and all of that. But if you think about it, is that really where Democrats or liberals want to go? That political officials representing an incoming administration are going to be held legally liable for policy conversations that they were authorized to have by the head of the on the bizarre grounds that you shouldn't be doing politics in the, you know, in the transition period? That's balderdash.
Yeah, but you're also oversimplifying it. And this is sort of a getting Al Capone on tax evasion thing. He was on the payroll of the Turkish government while he was national security.
Yeah, well,
advisor.
He wasn't accused of being on a payroll.
No,
he
but that's why Republicans aren't going to say one word about
it. I am not talking about Republicans. I know that he was on the payroll of the Turks. That had nothing to do with why he actually
resigned. And
he
was also unmasked. And it was a blatant violation of just about every norm that we have. And no one is going to litigate it because he was a bad actor.
But I'm not talking about... All I'm saying is I'm not talking about defending Mike Flynn or what. You know, Mike Flynn pled guilty because they went after his son and, you know, whatever, and this stuff is horrible, and, you know, politics ain't beanbag, and he is a foolish person and did foolish things. What I'm saying is that from the very outset, there was an effort to criminalize relatively normal behavior, successfully criminalize relatively normal behavior, and then mix that up with the really serious question that Christine raised about what are we going to do about Russian interference? And we are now hampered from doing stuff about Russian interference because of that, right? Because Trump has basically said it's all a hoax. Now, but to be fair, he's saying the Mueller investigation was a hoax. I don't think he's ever said that the idea that the Russians may have been playing footsie, you know, or trying... When did he said?
Well, Trump said.
Well, in Helsinki, fair enough. Okay,
but is that when he said? Where you said Putin says he didn't do it, and I believe him. Yeah. But you know, but that could also be, you know, this whole issue could be another one of those things. I think it is one of those things where Trump says one thing and then his administration acts in a different way.
But I mean, for example, there is a piece of legislation to secure. I don't even know what it's called. It's like Securing the Vote Act or something. That that has not been brought up for a vote in the Senate. McConnell has not put it up for a vote in the Senate. This will be an interest. Like maybe he can now. In other words, like if impeachment's off the table, he doesn't have to give. And the idea is that this somehow gives weight to the case for impeachment, or is some kind of a substitute for impeachment. Then he won't do it, but maybe he'll do it otherwise. I don't even know if it's effective, you know. And by the way, the other problem, I agree with you, Christine, and I don't want to now like go into becoming a total, you know, freakonomics. I'm just objecting to everything everybody says. But you know, some of the cases about how the Russians attempted to interfere are ludicrous. You know, the impressions on Facebook. The robotic Twitter feeds that, you know, attack people, including me. I mean, really? That's changed enough votes to make the slightest difference anywhere? I mean,
well, you know, and we actually have some data already about how many people open, for example, some of the fake news stories, which were dominating the headlines for a while as an example of Russian interference. And it was an extremely small percentage of Americans who actually opened that stuff and read it. So the media has done a great job of kind of creating a panic-like mindset around it. That said, I also think it was an interesting moment for Republican defenders of Trump when, and this drove Democrats mad yesterday, that when some of the conspiracy theorists were being spouted by Republican members of Congress, and Mueller didn't engage or try to defend there. He just kind of didn't engage at all. And I know that there were definitely some Democrats, you saw them all over social media, saying, you know, why doesn't he strike that down? Why doesn't he tell them that they're wrong? And I really want to offer a kind of mild defense of Mueller, because I think he did exactly what he said he was going to do, and he pissed both sides off. So I kind of admire him for that. And yeah, he's older, but I didn't find him to be lacking in the ability to discuss what he's doing. I wonder if a lot of the reaction to his demeanor is the result of a public that's become habituated to reacting on Twitter time and cable news time, right? You want immediate, loud, angry responses to every question. And that's just not his jam.
I don't know. I have to disagree with you on this. I thought that he was extraordinarily disrespectful as a witness. He's brought in, he's sworn in, he has sworn to answer these questions. He made decisions where he said, I'm not going to get into that, and I'm not going to get into this, and I'm not going to get into the other thing. And his excuse for it was there are ongoing investigations or something like that. That's crap. He was making unilateral choices about what it was he was going to answer and not answer. Witnesses before Congress, sworn in before the Judiciary and the Intelligence Committee, do not have the right to decide what questions they will and will not answer. He was given massive deference by, I think, by the chairman of the two committees, because they were still hung up on the idea that he was a national hero who was somehow going to save the country from Trump. When it became clear after about 7 minutes of the hearing that that was not true, there was no reason for them to continue to provide him with that deference. And actually, in some ways, the Republican hostility toward him, whether or not you think it's legitimate because of the arguments they were making or not, the Republican was more proper in terms of the way he was behaving in front of a duly constituted these two duly constituted investigative committees. Like, what right does he have to say, I'm not going to answer that? And he said it 147 times. I'm not going to get into that. I'm not going to get into that. Now, I think the reason is that he didn't know what he was talking about, and he didn't know it was in the report. He doesn't know. He didn't write the report. He doesn't know what's in the report. There may be something cognitively wrong with him, or he may just have checked out of the process after he was named, and he didn't want to have anything to do with it. And so he needed that guy, Aaron Zibley, next to him, because Aaron Zibley actually ran the investigation, according to the New York Times, and knows what's in the report, unlike Mueller. It's weird not to want to answer questions. Why wouldn't he want to answer questions? What garbage is this? He did this report. He's a public servant. He's before Congress. Why wouldn't he want to answer questions about the report if he's proud of the report? He said, I'm not going to go beyond the bounds of the report in a press conference. That's fine. But he's not the boss of Gerald Nadler or the House. That's ridiculous. I mean, that's the thing. The only excuse for that conduct is mental impairment. That he's just, you know, and there were a couple of moments when you have to, you know, when he refused to read the excerpts that were on the screen, when he said, I want you to read it. So the congressman would put it up. Why couldn't he read the excerpts on the screen?
Because they were he's not giving Democratic ad makers sound bites.
Yeah, please. Why? Yeah, why not? Why not?
Because he's not a political actor?
Yeah.
I agree with Noah. I think he was just kind of disgusted by the circus it had all become. I mean, I see your point, John, about him not really behaving the way a witness should. But, I mean, you see, look, Mark Zuckerberg was dragged before Congress, and he didn't do it quite so blatantly. But every time he was asked something he didn't want to answer, he kind of hemmed and hawed and said, oh, I'll get back to you
it
on
really
that.
It really does happen all the time.
Yeah.
No, but not as blatantly as this, and not somebody who was testifying about his report about whether or not the president should be impeached. I mean, Mark Zuckerberg.
Just because the gravity of the circumstance of a congressional hearing is different doesn't make the circumstance any less a circus. Congressional hearings are circuses; they're all theater.
Okay.
It's a good thing that somebody treated it like one.
But this then goes to the deeper question about Mueller. So let's go to the deeper question about Mueller for a second. Okay. He wrote these two sides of the report, right? And he says in the second part of the report, we decided that we couldn't indict the president based on the Office of Legal Counsel guidance written in the late 70s or whatever, and then updated in the 90s. And Attorney General Barr said at the first part where he announced the findings, said, I never said that he couldn't indict the president. I never insisted on OLC. No one... As far as I know, no one ever insisted that they follow the OLC guidance. So it was Mueller's own unilateral decision at some point in this process that Trump was not going to be indicted. Well, why doesn't he have to answer questions about that? What right does he have not to answer questions about that? That was a judgment call that the pro-Trump, pro-unitary executive attorney general said... He didn't agree with. He's not sure that that guidance is proper or appropriate. So something is off here. You don't just get to do whatever the hell you want and then not and be, you know, it, just because like Jeff Sessions recused himself and everybody who was his boss got fired. Mueller then says, I'm writing this report. Here it is. It speaks for itself. I'm not going to answer any questions about it. But it raises questions that are going to haunt the country for the rest of its existence. Where are these cases of obstruction, the 10 cases outlined in part two? If they're obstruction, why wasn't it? If he told Don McGahn to fire Mueller, if Trump told Don McGahn to fire Mueller and Mueller didn't fire Don McGahn, is that obstruction or not? Why is he laying out this narrative in this report about how this happened with Don McGahn if he was not using it as supporting evidence for a charge of obstruction? When do you lay out a narrative in a document that is supposed to explain why or why you did not charge or saw charges of something without saying whether the case met the standard of conspiracy or obstruction? Like, that's bizarre. The report is a sort of legal and intellectual shambles in that respect. And just because the House didn't know what the hell to do because they had decided on this ludicrous narrative that they were going to sit there praising Mueller for 3 hours about how wonderful he was in every possible way, didn't mean they don't have the right to ask the questions. And so, yeah, so they're naked political performances. But, I mean, if he personally believed that he shouldn't indict the president, because it went beyond his writ or his mandate or suggested that he do so, he could have said that without saying, well, I have no opinion about this, but the Office of Legal Counsel wrote a memo once, so that's what we have to do. Who the hell is the Office of Legal Counsel? These are not binding legal documents. The Office of Legal Counsel exists inside the Justice Department to provide guidance, and that guidance is not holy writ. It's not an executive order. It doesn't have any standing except out, you know, as a thing that you use as guidance. And you don't have to take guidance, by the way. That's one of the definitions of guidance, is that it's a way of going that you don't necessarily have to follow. And now I need to talk to you guys about our latest advertiser, and I'm trying to find the ad because I supposedly had all this done. And okay, here we go, everybody. It's ExpressVPN. Very important in the era of the Russia investigation, because when you're preparing to travel abroad this summer, there are a lot of things on your checklist to pack, but what's probably missing is the one app that's going to keep you safe and secure online while you're away, ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN doesn't just encrypt your data while you surf the internet on public airport and hotel Wi-Fi. It even lets you stream and access content that normally would have been blocked in that country. With ExpressVPN, you can unblock all of your favorite websites and have access to the internet just like you would if you were home. ExpressVPN runs in the background of your computer or phone, and then you use the internet just like you normally would. You download the app, click to connect, and voila, you're protected. It's the fastest VPN you'll try, costs less than $7 per month, and comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee. It uses new cutting-edge technology called Trusted Server to make sure there's no logs of what you do online. So no matter what you're trying to browse online, ExpressVPN gives you instant access all over the world. Don't travel anywhere this summer without downloading ExpressVPN. Protect your online activity today and find out how you can get 3 months free at expressvpn.com/commentary. That's expressvpn.com/commentary for 3 months free with a one-year package. Visit expressvpn.com/commentary to learn more. So, Abe, we were talking earlier about how the Mueller report follows this dud of a day, follows many previous duds of days in which the left had held out hope against hope, or the resistance, that this was the moment that was going to get Trump.
Every time there's this momentous news event that is supposed to deliver a death blow to Trump or to say something substantive, finally, about a certain conspiracy, the Democrats and the left lose big time. This happened with the Barr letter, then with Mueller's comments on the Barr letter.
Well, let's go back.
Yeah, even before that.
Let's see. We can go to Comey's testimony.
That's right.
We can go to Michael Cohen's testimony.
That's right.
We can go to I mean, there were other, I'm trying to think of other moments. There have been like six or seven moments that it's like something's going to happen in 6 weeks that is going to blow this presidency wide open. Or something that, like, you know, there's going to be a hearing in 6 weeks, or a book is going to come out in 5 weeks, or something like that. And there's a huge, Avenatti, right? The Avenatti stuff, Stormy Daniels stuff. And then it goes, and then the dust clears, and everything is static, right? Because the battle lines have been drawn. And there are these moments when Trump has hurt himself, but they never come in relation to the resistance, right? The most notable one being Charlottesville, right? When his polls went down 10 points across the board, practically, in the immediate wake of the Charlottesville comments. And he did that to himself. It had nothing to do with 2016, had nothing to do with the Russians, had nothing to do with anything like that.
You know, I've got to say, I think in this wish for one of these spectacular blows to Trump, to something that will unfold on television screens all at once and decisively rid the left of their nightmare, there's a laziness in this, right? Because they want to sit back and wait for this thing to just happen, as opposed to doing the hard work of ensuring that he doesn't get reelected.
Well, that's exactly right. I think that's a really important point, because it also allows them to avoid the internal tensions that exist in their own party right now, but not just with regard to how to deal with Trump, but how to even make reasonable policies, you know, coming out of a Democratic-controlled Congress. So I think that's super important. Yeah, it is a strangely, for all of the agitation you see, it's a strangely passive resistance, right?
Well, so I was noticing that in social media over the last couple of weeks, there's been a kind of weird thing that people keep putting up, which is, why aren't we marching? We should be marching. We should be saying we can't put up with this anymore. I guess reignited by the center back comments, right? We should be marching and marching and marching. Of course, no, you shouldn't be marching. You should be organizing. You should be figuring out, you should be giving money to the candidate you want. You should be figuring out how to get more Democrats to the polls in Michigan, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Wisconsin.
Well, that is happening.
And Florida.
It's just not happening on social media.
Right. But I'm saying you can't have enough of that. Like, you know, there's, you know, the last thing you need to be doing is playing emotive politics. That doesn't help, and in fact may well set you back, because emotive politics creates a counter emotive politics, and that's where you get standoffs. So if you had, you know, so if you had marches, then you would have Trump marches, and then everything would be back to zero.
Yeah, I gotta say, this is a function of the venue in which you're searching on here. I mean, the story of 2018 was a story of organizational outmatch
exactly.
and donations that outmatched Republicans 3-1.
Exactly.
The 2017 marching transitioned into organization, and we have no indication that stopped in 2019.
Okay, I'm not saying that it stopped or didn't stop. I'm talking about where emotional energy is directed. And here's the thing. So imagine that it's November 2018. Democrats have won 40 districts away from Republicans, right? Which has two interesting aspects to it. One of which is that it indicates that, in fact, Trump has hurt the Republican Party in the suburbs really terribly, and the people went out to vote to get him out of office, or to, you know, basically to get the Republicans out of office to punish him for his bad behavior. That's number one. And now I've forgotten number two, because I'm like Robert Mueller. Number two is even more important.
I mean, we look back on all this, there's definitely a failure on Democratic part to manage expectations, particularly around the Mueller investigation from beginning to end, notably even when these hearings occurred. But there's a temptation, I think, to look at this from the lens of right now. And in retrospect, in 2021, if we're inaugurating a new president, and Democrats have a better than even chance of winning the Senate, too, they have a much better map than they had in
2019. No, you're looking at that Alan Abramowitz piece on the crystal ball, and mm-hmm. Alan Abramowitz is not to be taken seriously as an electoral analyst.
I read the analysis.
I read it, and basically it says... Convincing. if 17 different things are true in November 2020 as they are right now, then Democrats have a better than.
So everybody's going to poo-poo it, and then we look back on these moments and say, well, obviously you can't have a president who's surrounded himself with incompetence, who inflames passions, who has no legislative victories to his name except for one reform effort and one tax reform effort. Of course you can't have this happen and expect to win re-election, and it'll be obvious in retrospect.
Okay, well, yeah, everything's obvious in retrospect. It's obvious that Hillary Clinton should have gone to Wisconsin and she didn't go to Wisconsin, but that's not the way politics works, number one. Number two, here's what I was going to say was the number two thing about what happened in 2018 is that Democrats won swing districts, and then the default politics since the end of 2018, the entire debate in the party has been between left and lefter. I mean, that's the interesting fallout, when at the ginger moments when Nancy Pelosi says, I don't know why you're paying attention to the squad, when there are 40 people who won seats away from Republicans who are in the House who are way more politically meaningful than these three leftists who come from leftist districts where they replaced liberal and leftist Congress members. And then everybody yells at her and shouts her down and says she's terrible. That's crazy. Like, the question is, getting back to the Democrats being crazy. And the presumption of the shock victory of 2016, one of the reasons that the Mueller probe was so important to people emotionally was that the investigation into Russian interference then meant that the Russians handed the elections to Trump, and that Trump and the Obama people clearly believed this, because this is what they were doing during the transition, was desperately trying to investigate whether Trump was a Russian puppet and had been installed, you know, to be Putin's cat's paw, right? Is that this explained this inexplicable. There was a simple explanation for the inexplicable. The Russians turned 100,000 people to, you know, the dark side, and therefore Trump's election was illegitimate. It wasn't legitimate. It wasn't just illegitimate because he lost by 3 million votes nationwide. It was illegitimate because he was installed illegally.
I was going to say, and Hillary Clinton has contributed to that narrative in the years since her defeat. I mean, it's not just conspiracy theorists on Twitter on the left. I mean, the major Democratic Party figures have continued to...
No, the entire... Eric Swalwell said... I mean, people have said... People, legitimately elected people, seriously, have said with a straight face that Trump is president because Russia made it happen. That's why they quit Facebook, right? Yeah. This whole mass quitting of Facebook, because Facebook was the means by which evilly, you know, Putin got people to vote for Trump.
And again, that's extraordinarily lazy, right? For all their outrage and anger, instead of looking at their own party, looking at the country, they sort of just rely on this fantasy, this explanatory fantasy, and then sort of wait for it to be avenged.
Right.
So how are those moderate Democrats who took those formerly Republican districts and swung them to the Democrats, how are they going to sell the Mueller report to their constituents when they're up for re-election in 2020?
I mean, I don't think they have to. It's not clear. We don't know what the ideological makeup of their constituents are in this sense, which is that they are in districts that Republicans won. And now, you know, they won. And I think they can say, we don't like Trump, we don't like his policies and everything like that. And so we're going to beat him fair and square, right? We did it in 2018, we can do it in 2020. Everybody, it's that thing. If everybody who voted for me comes out in 2020 the way they did in 2018, we got a good shot at winning this presidency. You know, I mean, that is the real thing.
Shouldn't the Mueller report on some level be very damning for the Democrats, in that Biden in particular, in that the extensive Russian meddling happened entirely on his watch, on Obama's watch?
Well, that's what Trump... Also, Trump said that before he decided that he was going to say that it didn't matter, right? He said, why are you blaming me?
Said that you know, we wouldn't have let something like this happen.
Yeah, but they're relying on the very tried and true, consistent, brief historical memory of most American voters. I mean, Biden just the other day on the campaign trail was promising never to put children in cages like Trump does on the border. And you're thinking, oops, you know, we actually know that's been a problem when you were vice president. So yeah, I think they're just relying on people not having the historical memory to question that.
Yeah.
Now, but that's ultimately why no one is going to talk about Mueller at all in 2020. I mean, it's been a dud. Right, no one's going to cling to a dud over the course of an election year in which we're going to have 2 week news cycles.
But when we began the podcast, I thought you said that the people
were
going to be talking
about this. It's going to be a talking point, but it's not going to be a central theme of the campaign. There's no campaign that they're going to wage on it because there's no campaign to be waged on it. What they're going to talk about is Donald Trump's general demeanor, because they can't talk about foreign wars, they can't talk about the economy, they can't talk even about corruption within the administration. It's all about the president, and that's one facet of the argument they're going to make against the president.
Right, which to me goes back to this counterfactual, which is, what if they hadn't gotten themselves insanely waylaid by this delusional theory that Russia cost the election? What if they had focused on emoluments? If they had focused on the Trump Hotel, on, you know, the government paying Mar-a-Lago to host, you know, Trump's Western White House.
The petty corruptions of all of his administration and staff. I mean, there's so many examples.
Yeah, like...
But the problem with that is there's too many examples coherent argument.
No, that's the point. You could say there were 275 cases of
corruption. But that's it. I can't go into Tom Price.
But you also don't know if you had spent your entire emotional energy on focusing on something like that as opposed to on Russia, and you had focused your investigative money and your investigative dollars in the media on that, there's no telling what you could have dug up that hasn't been dug up. I mean, all I'm saying is that this was a monumental miscalculation, and it was an emotional miscalculation. And I mean, maybe therefore it's a good thing that it came out the way it did. So the report, as even Barr said the day that he said, the report does not exonerate the president. Right? That was the first thing he said, and then Trump said total exoneration. Well, in an odd way, he's right, because by not indicting him on the basis of what the Democratic theory of the case was, he's exonerated. I mean, the report says that we cannot exonerate the president. That was, of course, the other interesting moment of disputation that Mueller simply didn't engage in, which was when this guy, Representative Armstrong from, I can't remember which Dakota, who was a freshman, was extremely impressive, said, under what legal standard is exoneration a thing that happens in an investigation of a potentially criminal act? You created a standard according to which you could theoretically have exonerated the president. There is no such thing as exoneration in the law. And then Mueller had that, you know, deer in the headlights look, and like he wasn't really listening and didn't really get anywhere. The other question, though, is, what about our friends on our side? Are they going to spend another 16 months yelling about Konstantin Kilimnik, whose name came up 200 times yesterday? Or, you know, Joseph Mifsud? Are they going to drop this now because the investigation was dropped? Or are they now so committed to the narrative that an unprecedented effort was made to destroy a presidential campaign by creating a document, by the way, the Steele dossier, that was not leaked before the election? So I therefore don't really understand how, if the document was created in order to destroy Trump, and then it wasn't leaked so that it could destroy Trump, how the document was created to destroy Trump.
Well, just as Democrats can't talk about foreign wars or the economy or legislative efforts on their part, you know, all the HR1 and what have you, because no one's interested, Trump isn't interested in talking about any of that stuff either. All he wants to talk about is himself and his personal slights. And to the extent that he has transformed the Republican Party into an image of himself, then yes, they will continue to talk about that, because that is what energizes him, and what energizes him energizes the Republican base.
But, you know, again, he's not dumb. Animal cunning about politics, like...
He was so cunning about politics that he made the closing argument in 2018 about caravans and lost the election.
But the animal cunning here would be to drop the whole subject of Russia altogether. If the, you know, say, what do you, why are you even still...
Advisors told him in 2018 to make the election about himself because Republicans were not energized to go out and vote. And also because he was talking about a red wave or all that nonsense. But they just weren't energized. And so in 2020, when he's actually on the ballot, he's going to spend the entire time talking about himself. Look at what he talks about at rallies when he's off script. He doesn't talk about legislative achievements or the state of the economy or even immigration for the most part. He talks about what he wants to do. But it is generally about himself and how he's perceived and how he perceives his enemies. And he likes to talk about that's what gets him up in the morning. And that's what he's going to talk about. And so, yes, folks at the Federalist and what have you aren't going to be talking about the legislative accomplishments of the 115th Congress.
Okay. So what we have after Mueller, after 2.5 years of this stuff, after the resistance, after all the delusions, after his own bad behavior and everything like that, is polling that shows that he would get about the same number of votes in 2020 as he got in 2016. That, you know, or maybe a little less. So in some sense, you can say all of this did its work. It reinforced the reasons that Democrats hate him. It has convinced independents that they are suspicious of him. And then maybe in counterweight, it has hardened Republican support for him that might have been softer, that they voted for him because they weren't going to vote for Hillary and there was no other choice. But now they have a more affirmatively or more positive view of him than they had in general, Republicans in 2016. So you can say that all of this did its work by cementing the parties where they are and making sure that the fight for victory in 2020 is with whoever is left who just hasn't made up his mind. Now, it used to be 20 to 25% of the electorate in any election. That's how you could get Ronald Reagan going from 50 to 60%, you know, in or 50 to 58% between 80 and 84, and, you know, 40 to 49 states from 80 to 84. But now it's much smaller. But it's not so small that they won't clearly decide the election. Unless Democrats hate him so much that they can continue to turn out to have that insane 2018 turnout. I mean, you were Noah's reading Tim Liberta's book, American Carnage, to review it for commentary. And what is it that Congressman Will Hurd from Texas says?
I can actually pull it up because I took a screen grab of this one. It was so apocalyptic.
So basically, you know,
we got to really do this preamble for me.
Here's what I'm going to say. So Democrats got 62 million votes in 2018. And remember, Hillary Clinton got 66 million votes in 2016. There's never been a midterm election in which, I mean, that is, they only got 8% fewer votes than the Democratic Party got nationwide in a presidential election. That this is an extraordinary fact that Republicans who are sitting around going, as they do all the time, like, oh, I think he's just going to walk into the presidency. I mean, who can vote for these crazy people? Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, so this is Will Hurd. He represents a district on the Mexican border in Texas. Pretty anti-Trump guy. One of the few anti-Trump, outspoken anti-Trump
Republicans.
Very Russian.
He talks a lot about the...
He's a former CIA agent.
Well, so his big thing is the Russian interference. Yeah. Like, he was the Republican at the hearings.
He's a serious guy. Yeah. He's also a pretty anti-Trump guy. One of the few who survived the 2018, didn't retire, wasn't voted out. Quote, "It was near presidential turnout in 2018. The Republican base showed up, but it's shrinking as a percentage of the voting population." He's talking about his district in southern Texas. "In 2016... only one Texan Republican got less than 55% of the vote. That was me. In 2018, 12 got less than 55% of the vote. Two of them lost. The average difference in our margins from 2016 to 2018 was negative 15 points. This is a trend that has to be stopped. And the only way you stop it is by appealing to a broader base of people," et cetera, so forth. So that was the race in which Beto O'Rourke was running, who was a sort of a rock star, raised more than any U.S. Senate candidate has raised by $10 million, and had the support of a whole lot of media attention that is going to be much less focused on Texas, for example, in 2020 because of just the nature of the national environment. But you also have Arizona and Georgia and Ohio, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Florida, and all of those states are on the bubble.
North Carolina.
And North Carolina, which was a hard North Carolina was a hard win for Donald Trump. People didn't expect it to flip.
I continue to wonder, or really to be skeptical about the idea that the Republicans who came out for Trump in 2016 and then didn't come out for Republican candidates in 2018. I'm skeptical of the idea that they therefore...
That's not what Will Hurd said. Yeah. He didn't he say said that they Republicans did turn didn't out. Come out. They did.
He said they turned out, and but the, that the Democratic turnout
the Democratic
was
that
just
didn't show up in 16
yeah.
showed up in 18.
Yeah.
And there's no reason to expect they won't show up in 20.
Well, yeah. Well, we don't know that because we don't know what will depress them. In other words, so Hillary depressed them. You know, if it's Bernie Sanders, who, by the way, tweeted this bizarre thing that then someone eventually explained to me that I didn't understand about how when he's president, every 18-year-old citizen will get the right, will be able to vote. And I was like, what? The 26th Amendment guarantees 18-year-olds the right to vote. And then someone said, no, it's if they were felons, they get the right to vote. Now, how many 18-year-old felons who have been released from jail, or are they going to vote from jail or something like that? I still don't. When I read that, I thought, you know, he is there. By the way, this is something we should talk about maybe on the next podcast. Not that it's something that is really in our expertise wheelhouse, but every poll is showing that Bernie is melting down to Warren. You notice this? Warren's up. Warren's now in the CBS poll. Warren's at 20 and Biden's at 25 and Bernie's at 6. Warren's up 4, Bernie's down 5 or 6, something like that. Something happened that has turned the electorate toward Warren and against Sanders. And I'm not sure I know what, but when I looked at this tweet, I thought, well, he's pandering to something that I'm not entirely sure I get or what people want. But that's how you could, you know, if he ends up as the nominee, you think that won't depress votes and I don't know where, enough votes and places where people don't like communists to be president, even Democrats.
Suburbia.
I don't know. Anyhow, so I guess we should say goodbye for the weekend. Apparently, it's not going to be 200 degrees here on the East Coast the way it was last weekend. So, for those of you on the East Coast, please have a wonderfully pleasant weekend. If you're somewhere it's 100 degrees. Stay inside. Don't go outside. It's dangerous. For Abe, Christine, and Noah, I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.